This is Mate, a podcast about marketing, advertising, technology, and entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Adam Jaffrey, and I'm a digital strategist, a podcaster, and an entrepreneur. Today, I'm speaking to John Wall, and this is a really humbling experience because John is also a marketing podcaster. He's the host of Marketing Over Coffee. It's a fantastic show that's been running for over 10 years. It was one of the first marketing-focused shows on the iTunes Store. And we talk about how he built the show, what opportunities it's given him, and John tells me about some of the amazing marketing lessons he's learned speaking to the smartest guests in the world on his podcast. So let's go talk to him. So who are you and what do you do?
My name is John Wall. I'm the host of Marketing Over Coffee. That's probably what I'm known best for. But I am also the vice president of marketing at Event Hero, a company that does event technology, badging and lead retrieval kind of things. And that's kind of the big labels. Of course, father and photographer and other stuff. But that's the labels I wear the most.
I love it. So John, I've been listening to your voice for... maybe 8 years, I don't know, a long time, back when I was still at university. And I was telling someone the other day, actually, that I feel like I learned more from podcasts than I did from my university degree. And podcasts were free, and my university degree cost me many, many thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. And I can quite confidently say that Marketing Over Coffee is one of the podcasts that... that taught me all the fundamentals of what I know. So, congratulations and thank you.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. I'd love to hear that because, yeah, that's really what kind of the seed of the show and where it all comes from is because this field changes so fast and so rapidly. Yeah, academics can't keep up whatsoever. And we kind of have to band together on our own. And, yeah, I've gotten tons of advice from people that have just thrown it out there to help. And, it's educate and entertain has always been the motto of the show.
Yep. All right. Well, let's get to that a little later. I want to start off, though, with what you're doing right now. So, you talked about Event Hero. What is it? What do you guys do?
So, I jumped at a chance to work with John Federico is really the first thing. John was at Audible prior to their acquisition by Amazon. And there was a point after that where I almost ended up working with him. And then this opportunity came up and it's about 3 years ago now for me. And we have all done events and marketing and trade show stuff. And one of the pain points has always been lead retrieval, you know, where you have to, somebody gives you this crummy device that you scan a badge with at a show so that you can follow up with them. And the whole idea of Event Hero, when we had started out, what pulled me in was the fact that, you know, replace all that junk and overhead with a phone, an app for your phone. You know, so if you're going to go work a trade show, you download the app. Now you can scan everybody's badges. You can go up to the cloud, download your file, and it just makes all that friction go away. And since then, we've added a bunch of other stuff. There's badging is included as part of that, and what we call multi-session tracking, where you can track your sessions and actually see, you know, how many people are in the keynote right now and do some cool stuff as far as after they've checked in on the way out, you can actually send them a text message or an email so that they can take a survey. So, you again, a whole another swath of paper that just vanishes. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing was, you know, doing stuff that used to cost $500,000 for an event and now making that available for less than $10,000 is kind of the big idea and the big thing. And again, I've always loved events and that part of the world. So it was a great opportunity to just try something new and, yeah, really get the entrepreneurial thing going.
Mm. And we're seeing that kind of thing happen in a lot of industries, right? Things that costed hundreds of thousands of dollars are becoming almost free. It's definitely a great innovation. And I'm excited to see where you guys go. So you're the vice president of marketing there. What's with all this vice president stuff? I think it's a very American term. We don't call people vice presidents. Well, we don't even have a president of Australia. We're part of the monarchy, so we have a prime minister. But yeah, vice presidencies and heads of departments. It's just a weird way of. I find it a weird way of referring to people. So, what does it mean?
Yeah, well, it's even funnier too. I hadn't thought about it much until you mentioned that because, for example, Event Hero has John as the CEO and co-founder. So there's even no presidents. I'm a vice president with no other presidents, but. In the States, it's always been big. I think it really came from kind of banking and finance, you know, New York City type stuff where, you know, you'd have people that have 10 or 20 years, but there's still not enough seats at the boardroom table. So vice president kind of became the coin of the realm for that upper level marketing guy. And then there's also this weird thing too over here. I don't know if you guys have a similar thing where there's definitely like a pecking order, like a CMO doesn't have to take meetings from vice presidents, you know? And so, and if you're a software company, it doesn't even matter if you're that big as a software company, you're going to want to have a CMO because you need to talk to other CMOs if you want to sell your stuff. So, yeah, the vice president is kind of an oddball thing. And the other ridiculous thing is actually, I'm probably more of a, you know, VP of sales or chief revenue officer. I mean, I spend most of my time doing biz dev and deals and it's just, you know, yeah, I can create some of my own collateral on the side to support that. But really, yeah, at the size we're at, it's all about sales. So it's, yeah, I did, you know, wear that badge because it's that's the one I'm supposed to. People expect me to wear it, but it, more of a pretty much wearing every hat that you can wear.
It's interesting. I think if Event Hero was probably, because you guys are on the East Coast, right? If Event Hero was over on the West Coast, you might be chief growth hacker or some stupid job title like that. So.
Yeah, isn't it fun? Yeah, that is another crazy thing too. It's kind of like all the roles are off. And I hate to say, but you know, it's kind of like once you have some VC money behind you and you're not as worried about, you know, kind of just the staid and standard titles, you can get away from that. But yeah, I've never had a business card that says hacker on it. So I wear that as a badge of pride.
So it sounds like a VP is kind of like the head of, so VP of marketing is the head of marketing, but you're not on the board of directors. Would that be kind of a good way to summarize it?
Yeah. And I think that's pretty much the standard over here is that, well, it really depends on the company size. You know, if the company is under 20 million, a VP of marketing is basically, yeah, you're the guy doing all the marketing. That's, you know, you're the lead guy. And there is an expectation at that smaller level too, that you're kind of doing a lot of product and sales stuff. You know, you're not just a, focus solely on marketing itself, but really on growing the whole business. Mm. And then over 20 million, though, VP of marketing starts to become the, you know, all the VPs kind of become these pigeonholed jobs that, you know, you're not expected to venture out of your territory and you're going to be fighting with the other VPs over why your office is 2 square feet bigger than the guy next to you. And, you know, those kinds of Dilbert things.
Yeah. I find it fascinating that VPs and CMOs don't meet and there's this weird kind of political hierarchy that takes place. I don't know. I guess maybe that's just a factor of being part of much bigger organizations with a lot more politics and bureaucracy and things like that. So, it probably exists in Australia here too, but I just haven't grown up in kind of those huge bureaucratic organizations. I've spent most of my time in agency land, which is very traditionally a flat structure.
Yeah, sure. And growing quick and, you know, results oriented. Yeah, it's when you start to get to a point where the business is so big that, you know, there's even folks that have no revenue number tied to them. You know, it's literally a political, you know, you're kind of garnering favors and collecting political coins to stay alive in those environments.
Yeah. So Event Hero is a bit more of a startup, right? You've kind of, I guess, what's it been like transitioning from maybe a bit of a bigger organization into a startup?
Well, for me, I've been on a run. This is like my fifth startup. So, you know, the last big run I had was at Accurev, a software development tool. That was from like 2005 to 2010. And we grew that from about, when I came on board, they were already over 500,000 a year, but that ran all the way up to like 20 million before it was acquired. So that was a great run. I actually jumped out of there when it was around 12 or 14 million, I think. Prior to that was a startup called Tibersoft. That went from about 0 to 50 and then back down to 20. And I, you know, still made the cut and lasted another year or two over there. And then there's been like three other ones, you know, some more interesting than others. But this has been the first one where I've like put everything at risk. You know, it's basically, you know, burning my 401k. I say 401k too. That's in the States.
Superannuation. We call it superannuation. Yeah.
Your retirement fund or your pension or whatever you want to call it. So this is the one where, yeah, I'm taking all the risk on this one. But we're staying alive. So it's been a little strange. Let me think. Yeah, of the bigger ones I've had, those were all venture capital backed too. This is the first one I've done that we've bootstrapped, and the it's amazing how much the finance and investor community has changed and evolved over the past couple of years. Because when we came on originally, we were like, oh yeah, this will get VC back, no problem, because we had product, we already had customers, we were, you know, making some profits even. And but that was not the case. I mean, this is, events is not the sexiest of verticals. Mm-hmm. And even though it's profitable and makes money, you know, there's still people that doubt that it'll be $100 million in 5 years. And so that's actually a mark against you. So, but yeah, it's definitely, I've been on the non-traditional career path, and but then the crazy part is I don't think I could go back to Cubicle Land even if I wanted to now. I'd probably have become unmanageable.
So. Yeah, I find that happens. People who work for themselves or work in startups do kind of get this kind of culture shift and get a bit shell-shocked if they go back into a very structured organization. So, yeah, you probably are unmanageable, which is good in some ways because it means you don't need to be managed. So, yeah. So John, I feel like I've kind of followed this journey through some of your kind of career changes, and also Chris, the co-host of Marketing Over Coffee, Christopher Penn. And it's been really interesting to watch you guys over the last, well, I think it was 10 years, right? You guys just had your 10-year anniversary.
Yeah. Chris actually threw that out there, and I knew it was coming up. But yeah, because we're, 480 some episodes in 10 years. Yeah, it does not seem like it's been that long, but the years have piled up.
Wow. So congratulations, firstly, because that's a huge achievement. And I know I was listening to your show the other day, and you kind of just made a little touch, you made a little mention of it, and then just kind of breezed past. So I think you got to take a moment to celebrate. So I hope you guys grabbed a coffee and maybe some Dunkin' Donuts and celebrate it.
Yeah, to sell. Well, and that's always been one of the rules of the show, though. And it's funny too, and this is like ancient podcasting stuff, but like way back in the dark ages when, you know, the first people were doing podcasts, people would come on and they would just kind of like ramble, like, oh, hey, this is so great that I'm recording stuff and it's going to be on the internet. And, mm-hmm. you know, and so one of our catchphrases has always been no show about the show. Mm-hmm. You show up and you deliver the content. You don't kind of meander and talk about how cool your microphone is and ask people to send you in ideas of what you want to talk about and things like that. It's, you know, taking a more, trying to bring it up to a more professional level. So, but yeah, for the, I don't know, we do need to do some kind of anniversary thing at some point, but it's just, the time has not been right yet. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess like being 10 years old, Marketing Over Coffee is probably one of the first podcasts out there, let alone one of the first marketing podcasts, one of the first podcasts.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the earliest marketing podcasts. You know, there was a couple others that came on, but actually Chris and I had both been casting for about a year or two at least before we got together for Marketing Over Coffee.
Right.
I used to do this thing called the M Show, which was just like a 10-minute news and entertainment thing. And yeah, I did over 200 episodes of that, you know, before Marketing Over Coffee got really rolling. And then Chris was doing a podcast on financial aid. The company he was at that time, you know, did student loans and things like that. So we were both doing it. And but yeah, it's just been interesting to see how things have changed and grown over the years, because it yeah, really, the rest of the world has kind of shown up. You know, we were with the early adopter crew, and it was there. But just the past 3 years have been a totally different game as far as everything goes.
Mm. So, let's kind of just keep on this origin story for just a moment. I want to learn a little bit about how the show started and kind of why you came up with the name. The logo is a Dunkin' Donuts coffee mug. And I remember some of the earlier episodes were actually recorded in the coffee shop. So, can you kind of give me a bit of the origins backstory, kind of like the Marvel movies are going these days? Let's go back in time and see where it started.
Right. Go back to the origin story. So at the time, I had been doing that podcast, and it wasn't growing the way I wanted to. And so I quickly came to the realization that the way to go is to have unique content, you know, because I had seen, for example, Battlestar Galactica was hot at that moment, and there were a couple of people that had made casts and just had insane numbers. They got all these followers immediately. But then when the show itself started doing its own podcasts, all those got nuked instantly and wiped out. And then the same thing, I was actually, you know, my stuff was kind of just I was really modeling my thing after the meat of a radio DJ. You know, on the drive time commute, there's like a 10-minute chunk that's the best stuff, and then a ton of ads and garbage around it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized I wanted to go unique and marketing tech, and basically we always called it the intersection of marketing and technology, was something that I was doing cutting edge stuff with and always was trying to find the latest and greatest. And the real the kind of twist of fate for me was that Christopher Penn also lived within about 6 miles of me at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh, if we get on the mic together, I'm sure we can do something great. And so I pinged him. I was like, look, let's do this. Let's get on, you know, before you go drive into work for your commute, let's go hit Dunkin' Donuts and we can just record. And I was like, I'll meet you at 8 o'clock. He's like, no, I can't do it. I'm like, all right, I'll meet you at 7 o'clock. Why don't we do that? And he was like, no, that's still, I can't do it. I was like, how about 6 o'clock? I'll meet you at 6 in the morning. And we might have even gone to 5. I think there was a point where we were meeting at 5 in the morning over at the Dunks. But, you know, and it was at 6 o'clock for a good 3 or 4 years. So we would meet there at 6 in the morning, record for about half an hour, and then both drive off to work. And we both had these commutes from hell. And yeah, and it was in the Dunkin' Donuts. So there was always noise in the background. But it's, you know, and kind of a trick. If your sound is never pristine, having background noise is great because it kind of hides a multitude of sins.
Yeah.
And so that made it easy to work. And then listeners kind of got into it too of, you know, you'd always hear the coffee alarm go off and not stop because the staff would be sleeping. And we'd always be joking too because, you know, so we were literally at this Dunkin' Donuts for about 5 years. And, you know, we were never recognized at the register when we were buying our stuff. Like the staff would turn over so frequently that nobody still knew who the hell we were. And so that's kind of how it got off the ground, was us, you know, just, and marketing over coffee was just kind of like after brainstorming for about 3 days, you know, because we wanted to jump on board and get a URL immediately. So it's like, there was no real master plan behind it. It was just kind of like, let's throw this all together and see what sticks.
I love that you weren't recognized as, you know, kind of the customers that just come back for 5 years in a row, even though you're the most obvious people with a bunch of microphones and headphones and all this recording gear. Like, how more obvious could you be?
Yeah, no, it wouldn't be, you know, yeah, we were definitely recognizable. So, yeah, there were, once in a while, there'd be somebody that would hang around for 3 or 4 months and would at least like have some clue of what was going on. But yeah, it was just kind of silly to be, you know, the crazy customer and just have nobody even notice.
Mm-hmm. So you've kind of talked about how it started and kind of why you did the show. I want to ask about some of the show's successes. Like 10 years is obviously one of those, but you know, do you consider the show as a success?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Because the thing that has worked for me is that it's opened up a bunch of doors. I've had a chance to just talk to a lot of cool people that normally I would have to pay money to hang out with, you know, or see.
Yep.
And it's also opened up a bunch of things with, you know, a lot of publishers now and publicists know us as the, you know, one of the better gateways to this audience. And so we get free books and we get invited to conferences. And so, you know, we kind of have access to a great network of people. You know, it's kind of just the classic reciprocity thing of like, we throw content out there that people find useful. And so in return, people, you know, are more than happy to kind of throw us a bone now and then when somebody comes to town, or if somebody's, you know, looking for somebody to talk to, we get the doors open for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. So I was reading on the site about, you know, your kind of regular listenership, and so it's a weekly show. How many people are tuning in each week?
The average episode now, we've been breaking 10,000 an episode. So it's been a pretty nice up ramp. And usually then you throw on the back catalog and that's usually good for about 50,000 impressions a month. So
yep.
The numbers have been growing nicely. And now that's literally like a, about a 30% increase over the past 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Serial just totally changed the game for us. And it was funny, I was talking with Tom Webster of Edison, who's kind of like one of the leading stats guys on podcasting. And it was just interesting in that it wasn't Serial itself while it was running, but when Serial finished, all these people now were into podcasting and were looking for fresh stuff.
Yeah.
And so it was like, bang, as soon as that was over, the numbers have been growing. And yeah, and we've been on just a nice ramp lately of, you know, there's obviously more organic word of mouth than anything else we try to do to grow the show. And so, yeah, I'm just kind of thankful we've managed to kind of crack up into that, and hopefully it'll continue to keep growing on its own.
Yeah, it's great. And over the years, you've had a few different sponsors on the show. I know some of them were employers of yourself and Chris, which was kind of a nice fit and a nice kind of tie-in. But have you had kind of a strategy to find sponsors for the show? Because, you know, recording gear is expensive, right? And it's something that you dedicate a lot of time to, and it's not an insignificant cost, both financially and from your time perspective, to run a podcast. So, even just to kind of cover your costs, it's nice to have someone just footing the bill there. So, have you had a kind of strategy there to approach that?
The one thing is we've kind of gone with the whitelist thing of, you know, we don't have any sponsors that we wouldn't, you know, we don't stand by ourselves. And it is, it's a little bit unique in that, you know, it's a marketing podcast and we talk about marketing tools. So pretty much all the listeners are used to being sold and are always buying tools. So it's not like such a jarring sale for us. You know, I think, you know, if you were doing like a parent, you know, one of these mommy casts or daddy casts, you know, talking about kids, and then you start selling, you know, just some product that's totally out of right field, it can be jarring and weird. But the kind of vertical we're in is used to buying tools all the time and being sold to. So it kind of helps them out. But that's the big thing. It's just been obvious that the best sponsors have been the ones where it's the best fit. Like the gold standard for us has been, was Blue Sky Factory, the email marketing tool, which, you know, it's so funny. It actually went through three or four iterations, but you know, they got acquired while they were sponsoring the show. And one of the, you know, things that we had seen was that literally the marketing over coffee leads were better even than the demo requests that they would get to their own site. Yeah, because it's just, if somebody called for marketing over coffee, it was like they're doing email marketing and they're looking to buy a solution. You know, it's literally better than the folks that would come through the front door. And so we've had a lot of, we've worked with Marketing Profs many years too. They're another longstanding partner of the show. And I'm actually talking to them about coming back this summer here to get them in the door. Affinio was another great one too. We did a run with them. That's kind of a business intelligence for social media thing, you know, going into Twitter and data mining 2 million tweets and find out what the real answers were. And that was a great fit because every week I could literally take a story and we would run the data through Affinio. And so as part of the story, you know, we'd be able to shine some light on something else involved with it. Like, you know, hey, this isn't exactly the way you think it is because people tend to talk about this or that, or, you know, the customers for this product always tend to fall into these specific niches. And if you could advertise against that, and you'd make a huge win. So yeah, having a real tight fit between the product and content and the audience, having all three of those work together has really, it's allowed us to punch way above our weight. You know, a lot of advertisers, 50,000 a month is not the, you know, you're not going to get the car companies or insurance companies just buying raw traffic there. It's got to be something that fits tight.
Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the powers of podcasting. You know, the listeners of a podcast really trust the host. Or the hosts, it's actually a very intimate relationship. You know, we're talking before we hit record on this, and we're saying that I've been listening to your show for a long time, and I feel like I kind of know you, even though you have no idea who I am before we kind of get on the call. And it's because you're in my ear. It's not even like out of a speaker. You're in my ear every week talking about interesting things that bring me value. So, if you're recommending a product, it's almost like a personal recommendation from a friend. And that's so much more powerful than just seeing a banner ad on a website or even something like radio or TV. So it's it's really effective stuff.
It's much tighter. There's the intimacy, you hit it right in the head, that Leo Laporte always talks about. There's nothing more intimate than actually whispering into somebody's ear. You know, you're right there. And then just having the fit is can't be matched. And then there's the, you know, if you're not listening for more than 3 weeks, iTunes is going to kick you off. So we have recency too. It's pretty much everybody that downloads a file, you know, odds they're definitely listening to it. There is the weakness of metrics. People, advertisers are not happy with that, and that kind of, there's no direct knowledge of who's getting it and how long it's out there. But yeah, it's, you know, it's recent and fresh content, and everybody's part of the community. So it beats a lot of other channels.
Yeah. And I've had that criticism about the metric side of it a few times. You know, like in podcasting, one of the weaknesses is we don't know how many people actually listen to a show. We just know how many downloads there are of that MP3 file. But let's compare that to something like radio, where they get their listenership numbers from is they send out paper surveys to a sample size of 300 people in a city of 3 million, right? So, how accurate is that compared to an actual measurable download number?
It crushes radio. The ones that, unfortunately, people are kind of addicted to banners. You know, they're just like, oh, I want to know how many clicks. I want to know how many above the fold. And then I want to try and track all the way to conversion.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real dividing line to it. And we've hit that point now, too, where, below a certain mark, people are just doing demand gen. They're like, I want to spend $1 on ads and I want to have $2 by the end of the quarter,
mm-hmm.
which is one thing. And it is possible. It does work for some of our sponsors. But then there's the other side of it of like, we just need the whole community to know about this. And we realize that they may not buy this year, especially like marketing automation tools. Some of these tools have a 4 or 5 year life cycle at least.
Yep.
But, you've got to get in front of them. If that 5 year mark comes and they don't know who your brand is, like you're not going to get on the short list. So, but yeah, we've had more and more people talking more about the branding, end of things, people that just kind of throw their name out there and they're more interested in the awareness than the actual conversion. So it's nice to kind of hit that point, but it's weird too. Those people spread their money around all over the place. So it's not the same kind of relationship. It's more of a spray and pray for them.
It's true. And a kind of just final point I might say on sponsors is, I've been an avid podcast listener for, 8 or 10 years or so. And it's clear to me that podcasts build brands, Casper Mattresses, Audible, HelloFresh. These are brands that I would have never heard of. And I feel so intimate and so positive about them because of just the consistent podcast advertising that I've heard about them. Now, we don't have Casper here in Australia, but if I was to buy a new mattress, I would buy a Casper. I'm telling you right now. I just know that I would. And I wouldn't even bother researching the other options. I'd just buy a Casper. So, I think it's been effective from that point of view. So, you spoke a little while ago, John, about some of the opportunities that having the podcast has opened up for you. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that for me?
Well, I don't know. There's just so many weird things that go with that. Like, literally the past 5 years now, anytime that I'm, looking at a project or a job, I'm instantly the podcast guy. It's like, it doesn't matter how many other people they're talking to, then there's like, oh, there's the podcast guy. And they don't get, I don't get forgotten or overlooked. I may get passed over for somebody else, but I'm not going to be that guy that nobody can remember who they are. So, mm-hmm. So that's been huge just for my own brand. I think, being able to talk with Simon Sinek on a regular basis has just been amazing to kind of watch his career grow. And he really focused things for me when I first talked to him. The thing that got me was when he was talking about how he was working at Ogilvy and he could have a team of people do amazing, fantastic work, literally world-class stuff, winning awards. And then the next client would come in and they could do garbage that would flop.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew kind of right then and there, like, it's not about the people. There's something else there about the brand that determines whether or not it's going to live or die. And so that kind of changed everything, the way I thought about that stuff. Another one, and then like Seth Godin too. A lot of people kind of give him a hard time about being kind of self-help guru and kind of getting into things that are beyond marketing and sales. But he was really like right at a time where I was starting to do more entrepreneurial stuff. His writing encouraged me to take more risk and try different things and really changed my life in a positive way, it sounds kind of corny, but mentors come to you during your life and at different times, and he was with the right message at the right time for me, and so that was a big thing.
Mm. To be honest, I think Seth would probably give anyone the right message at the right time, no matter who they were. I think he's probably one of the most. I know you said kind of self-help, but I think he's one of the smartest marketing and business minds that we have today. So
I think he is a wise man. People we've kind of lost a bit of that in this age of data and information, but he has great wisdom in that he can kind of cut through the clutter and get right to the core of the problem and kind of fix it and get you on the right track.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke about a few kind of, influencers or some, really bright people, just there, some names like Seth Godin, Simon Sinek, Mitch Joel is another one who, you guys have spoken to a few times, and I know he appears on the Beancast. Actually, I interviewed Bob Norp, a little while ago. So you should check that episode out. But it seems to me that all of those names kind of are in the same circles. You guys kind of communicate a little bit and appear on each other's shows sometimes, and you're all kind of going to the same conferences and that sort of thing. Have you become friends over time, or has the podcast opened the door to some of these relationships, or is it a bit of both?
Yeah, it's kind of different with everybody, but there's a couple of themes. One is definitely, you talked about the conferences and shows, like Mitch Joel drove down from Canada took a 5-hour drive to come down to Boston for PodCamp 1 in Boston, which was like a good 10 years ago probably now. Mm-hmm. And so we got, literally this wild rock and roll bald guy was like, oh my God, I got to talk to you. And so he's been a friend ever since then, and he's been doing great stuff, and it's just a thrill to kind of know him. So he came in there. And then the other one, the big one, is just when you're in the game long enough, most people that are trying to crack into the space will write a book at some point. And when they write the book, they need everybody to jump on board and help promote it. So that's kind of the opportunity. Like that's, I'm trying to think of people that we've been lucky in that we've gotten in early. Like with Simon Sinek, he wasn't big when I first talked to him. Literally, I had a publicist reach out to me and say, hey, would you like to talk to him? Where he doesn't have that problem anymore. and then actually with Seth Godin, it's funny too. This is a good story, because I had always considered that Marketing Over Coffee would be a success if I got a chance to interview him. Like I just presumed I would never get a chance to interview him. That, like, he has no need to talk to, my audience, because they 99% of them already know him and buy his book. So it's useless. But I had a blog post where I was talking about negative feedback on Amazon. And I had just read something by Seth about the same thing. And I was like, I would love his opinion on that. And so in the blog post, I put, look, I'll give $100 to Seth Godin if he comes and posts a comment on this topic to tell us what he thinks about it. And sure enough, like within about 5 weeks, somebody through the podcast that read my blog who knew him pinged him and said, hey, look, this guy threw $100 out if you'll go and give him, your 5 cents here.
Because he needs $100, doesn't he?
Right, exactly. Yeah. My whole thought was that was just like, I want to be bold, let me put $100 out there, because that's totally not a paltry sum. And to his credit too, he totally came up with, and this has been a long running theme on the show too, actually, and God, we need an update on this. He said, look, I don't need $100. Go to Kiva, which is a micro lending site, and give $100 over there. Mm-hmm. And so then for the next 2 years on the show, we were telling the story of the Kiva loan. Like we helped out a cab driver in Africa and some lady with a used clothing business in India and a small business guy in Texas to get a new truck for his craftsman business thing. It's just like all this crazy stuff that sprung out of that. So by throwing that bold off, Seth has been on 4 or 5 times now. Every time he does a new book, I've had a chance to talk to him, and it's always been fascinating stuff. And yeah, and he has his own crowd. Hell, it's been more, it's more benefit to me than to him for his book. So he's a kind man for doing it, and I greatly appreciate it.
Mm. It's funny, when I started this podcast, I was thinking, what would I consider a success? And really one of the reasons I actually do this podcast is so that I can interview smart and interesting people, and just have an excuse to do that. Here in Melbourne, I would go and have coffee with people doing interesting things in marketing and technology. But it was kind of an excuse for me to speak to people outside that realm. And I took the show on the road last year, traveled through the States and met some great people there. And I'm interviewing people, like yourself. And so I kind of had this thought that, the two people I think that would have really, the pinnacle of, if I could interview Seth and if I could interview Richard Branson, I'd be like, wow, that's kind of the two people that would make Mate all worth it, because it's a labor of love, right? You don't get much back for it. So that's kind of always been the goal for me.
Oh yeah. Well now with Seth, you should check if he still has copies. He has this insane book that's like an 18-pound book, and it costs like $185, and it's this giant thing. But yeah, if you bought a copy of that, I'm sure you could probably get him to come on and talk about it. He would be willing to do that. You just have to, because he does answer his own email too, which is a lot of folks don't. But and the key with him is just brevity. Literally in the subject line, be like, got your book, and then would love to get you on the podcast, and that's your whole message to him. And fire it early in the morning too, because he's one of those who cleans out the inbox early in the morning. That's a, it's funny over time. Do you find people that do stuff like that? You know, certain people, you know when to hit them to increase your odds.
Yep. Oh, I find depending on the channel as well. So Seth's probably an email guy, but I know some people are via Twitter, or some people are via LinkedIn, or some are text message. So it's interesting. You kind of play to people's strengths. You got to help them help you.
right. Increase the odds, always up the points.
So, John, you're talking before about people in this space writing books and wanting to promote them on other people's podcasts and that kind of thing. And you've been down that journey yourself. So, you've written a book. It's called B2B Marketing Confessions. Can you give me a bit of an overview of what the book's about?
Sure. Yeah. The idea was just, you know, I had been doing so much work in this space for so long that I wanted to kind of put it all together and write a book and become an author. That was really the main goal, was just like, you know, let's see how much of this stuff I can put together and put on one point. And it was, yeah, it was quite an experience just to actually, you know, go through all the work of writing a book and the hundreds of hours you pour into it. And I'm glad I did it. But right now I've just been too busy with other things to kind of think about what the next thing's going to be. But, you know, at some point I would love to do it again, because I learned so much from it the first time that I would do a whole lot of stuff differently. But, it's just a matter of finding the time to get into it.
So, what was the hardest thing about writing the book then? Because it was interesting, your introduction there, you said pour hundreds of hours into it and it was a great experience, but, and then you kind of went on this tirade. So, what kind of follows the but?
Yeah, well, the big thing with it is you kind of, you know, when you first set out to write something, you're kind of like, if I write a great book, it's gonna sell and it will do well. And you kind of just think that like writing a great book is enough. And then the heartbreak is kind of like it's almost the opposite. Like your book actually doesn't need to be that good. To be popular, you have to play down a lot of what you're doing. And really, it would be best, if you want to be exceptionally popular, to boil it down to, you know, three big ideas. And you kind of want to go a self-help route too, of, you know, promising the world. You know, there's a lot of books that are kind of promising to you that, you know, you could be make a lot more financially successful and do a whole lot less work. And, you know, any entrepreneur knows that that's completely baloney, but those are the books that sell. Those are the books that people want to buy. They're really looking for silver bullets. Uh-huh. And you know, that's what sells. So you kind of have to trade off of like, how academic do you want to get? Or, and once in a while too, there's a gem of an idea where, you know, something that's just so profound that it will sell like crazy. Like the classic one is David Meerman Scott's New Rules of Marketing and PR. Like he was just kind of like the right guy with the message at that time. And it was, the world was changing completely. And he was the guy who documented it at the right time. And that book has, you know, just become a Bible on its own. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's one thing to have a book that's best written, but that's not the same as a bestseller. So,
yeah, okay. And where would you say that B2B Marketing Confessions fits into that kind of spectrum of purely academic and factual to superfluous and almost like selling snake oil?
Yeah, exactly. The snake oil. No. B2B Marketing Confessions is a textbook for a B2B marketing person. Like if you are, the story I've always told with this was kind of at one point in my career too, where it was like, you know, the VP of marketing got cut in the latest round of layoffs. And now suddenly, you know, you're the guy who's been doing maybe three or four campaigns and you have to run the whole show. Mm-hmm. Like this book is your cookbook. It's your recipe book. You know, you could literally sit down with very little knowledge and at least come up with a plan to run the whole thing for 3 or 4 years with mm-hmm. that book. And I've heard that before, you know, from other readers. You know, there's kind of this small group of like 2,000 people that this book would be on your desk and your daily plan and what to do. You know, the problem is if you're not one of those 2,000 people, it's probably would be one of the most boring things you've ever picked up to read. And, you know, if you're not doing more than half the tactics in there, it's as unbearable as any other college textbook. So.
Okay, so maybe could you just give me like one or two of the kind of top recommendations that the book makes?
Oh, let's see. Well, the big thing, you know, and again, this is like a huge mistake of the book, is that, and in fact, yeah, and it's even funny, about a year and a half after it came out, Gabriel Weinberg and Justin Maris came out with their book Traction, mm-hmm. which they did a better job of codifying it. They actually have laid it out that there are 19 specific things that you can do to grow the business. Mm-hmm. And I haven't gone back to do the actual one-to-one, but I know that I have over 35 sections in there. So I've covered the majority of those 19. Mm-hmm. But they did a better job of wrapping it up into a package of the 19 things you need to know. You know, and I didn't do that. But the quick hits, it's funny too. And again, going back to the topical, there's a 5-page chunk in there on travel tips and hacks and, you know, things, you know, when you're traveling to trade shows and events and bringing the whole load with you, there's just, you pick up so many different, just ways to get through the airports faster, ways to get through customs checkpoints, and ways to get through the trade show floor faster. So those are all you know, big, huge things. It, even like I would always carry in the trade show box of stuff. And now this is a box that would have to go with the trade show stuff, because I would have all this stuff that would get me kicked out of the airport, like box cutters and, you know, screwdrivers and all that stuff. But one of the things in there was always a bottle of Jack Daniels too, because for a lot of big events at the end of the show, you have to wait for your crates to come back to you before you can pack up and leave. Well, the guys that are doing the crate loading are, they would be really excited for some Jack Daniels. If I was willing to hook them up with that bottle, and suddenly out of the, you know, 500 crate sets of crates that have to come back, my crates would come in the first load, and I would be out of there in a couple hours. And there would be people that would have to spend an extra day in the city because their crates might not show up till late the next morning.
Right.
And so, you know, that bottle could literally save me, you know, an extra flight and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So that's like just one of the crazy things that's, you know, you wouldn't think about until after you've seen somebody else do that and realize that it's a great way to get around.
And that, look, that's one of the things I really love about the podcast, Marketing Over Coffee, and also it's kind of mirrored in your book, that this whole thing of like practical advice. It's not kind of, like I was saying before, this superfluous snake oil stuff. It's actually things that someone can take and use, and it's kind of like a guidebook, or the podcast is kind of an audio guide to marketing in the modern world. So there's always kind of some really clear takeaways, and I think that's probably why the podcast has done so well, and people love the content that you guys put out. John, there was one other thing I wanted to ask on this topic of the book. Writing a book or publishing is something that I guess a lot of internet celebrities tend to do. We see it with YouTube celebrities and a lot of podcasters, and then they kind of go on the speaking trail as well. Or if you're maybe more of an entertainer rather than a marketing professional, you might go and do live shows or something like that. So, do you think that this is... well, particularly for you, was writing a book and kind of going that route a monetization play, or is it more to boost your profile, or what's kind of the... Because writing a book is not easy, as we've discussed, and it's a big challenge. So, why put yourself through that that heartache and all of that work?
Yeah, well, it is just, you know, throwing something out there to the world is like anything else, and that you, you know, if you have it in you, you're going to do it anyways. And yeah, and in my case, it was neither monetization or profile. It definitely has not worked on either front. the monetization has just been a joke. You know, it doesn't make any money. And that's actually, though, quite normal. I don't know any authors that have made a ton of money. The only close thing is there are some folks that publish some stuff that, like high-end consulting stuff, like $300 reports and things like that. Those people actually do make money on their content. But you hit it on the head. It's all about the public speaking thing. Mm-hmm. If you can get a best-selling book that lines up the public speaking, you make all the money on the public speaking. You know, the book still doesn't, you know, especially because if you go through a real publisher, you're only getting, you know, 25 cents to a dollar a book. So even if you sell 50,000 copies, which is an insanely huge success for a business book, you know, you're not making a ton of money given the hundreds of thousands of hours you dump into it. Mm-hmm. The profile boost is a big thing, though. And it's more of a badge than a door opener. You know, it's just kind of like, if you're at a certain level of speaking and doing stuff, it's just kind of expected that you're going to be an author. Like, you know, that kind of opens a lot of doors as mm-hmm. a published author, and it gives you some credibility. In fact, a guy I used to work with used to joke that it was a $20 business card. That's really what it is. You know, right. You can kind of throw that down and be like, look, you know, these guys have a business card, but here's 250 pages that explains what the hell my deal is. So
yeah, and also, instead of saying I'm a marketer and a podcaster, you can say I'm a marketer, a podcaster, an author, and a speaker. So it just kind of sounds a lot better, right?
Just another log to throw on the fire.
Exactly. So so John, you've been in the industry for a long time, and I wanted to kind of ask you, and kind of drawing on some of your experience from the podcast and the people you've interviewed, and kind of just all the culmination of all the experiences that you've had. What are some of the kind of key lessons you've learned about marketing and technology over those last, let's say, 10 years with the podcast?
Yeah, you know, one is that you can never make it too simple. You can never dumb it down too much. You know, in everything you do, you really want to eliminate all the friction you can, because it's just amazing. You know, you can spend so much time crafting something and think you've got it, you know, just right where it needs to be, and it's just no, it's not easy enough. It's not hitting hard enough. So yeah, just simplifying, making sure your copy is crisp and as tight as it can possibly be. You know, even if it's the best you can do, it's still not going to be tight enough. But you got to take that shot.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, you know, pitching value, pitching your beliefs, as opposed to pitching just features and price, is another mistake that a lot of people do. That, you know, the worst thing you want to do is get in a race to the bottom. I've seen that just so many times with products that, you know, you've got these customers and you don't really like them that much, and they're willing to leave you for a nickel. It's just, in the long run, that's just a terrible treadmill to be running on and have to burn your life on. And then the other just crazy thing, the big lesson, is you have to be a lifelong learner. You know, I mean, you're talking about regular academia. I mean, literally, I don't work on anything throughout my day or week that I could have learned about in college. Like, all of it is new. None of it existed, you know, when I went to school. And so, and that's just the way it's going to be. You know, it's only going to get worse on this front. So you have to constantly be adapting and figuring out what the next thing is, so that you've got an idea on what things are going to eventually become. So it's that real balance of the tech is always changing, but you still need to be able to have that personal belief and soul to be able to get in front of people and actually tell your story effectively and avoid the snake oil road.
It's funny. I speak to students and people who are looking to get into the marketing industry, and they say, you know, what can I do, and what do I need to work on, and that kind of thing. And one of my main messages is that if you want to work in marketing today, you have to live it. Like, you can't just go on Mashable once a month and see what's going on and read TechCrunch, you know, every now and then. You've got to be reading and learning about this stuff every single day. So, I love it and I live it, because it's always updating, and technology is just revolutionizing the marketing industry on a daily basis. Something new can launch and it changes the way that you approach Facebook or email marketing or whatever. But to contrast that, and it's kind of an interesting kind of interplay, the kind of strategies that we use are still all time tested. You know, marketing strategy as a function hasn't really, or shouldn't have, changed over the last 20, 30 years. How to approach a market, understanding your customer, choosing channels and outlining a message and having a clear, simple copy and a really direct call to action. Those are all pretty simple and time-tested marketing strategies. But I think, unfortunately, some of the marketers in today's world get a little bit excited about how technology is revolutionizing the industry. And I think they mistake tactics for strategy. So, it's kind of, you know, the strategy stays the same, but the tactics are always changing. So those are kind of my tips, and it sounds very similar to what you were saying. But I really love that idea of being a lifelong learner. So thanks for sharing those tips. Just in conclusion, John, a couple of final questions. What's one of the common mistakes that you see brands making in the industry right now?
you know, definitely going to that, back to that Simon Sinek thing of people focusing more on the what, you know, what is their product, what do we do, or the how, you know, and how we make our product and why it's better than the others, instead of going all the way up to why, you know, why do you do what you do? You really want to try and connect to your customers on a personal level and say, look, this is what we believe. You know, it's not about our computers are the best or we have the best supply chain, you know, that allows us to sell the best computers cheaply. It's, we think computers can change the way you, you know, do your job, and that, you know, our tools are going to be of the highest quality because we feel that that is the number one concern as a productivity tool for you. And so you've got kind of three levels of stuff there. It's just like, you know, generic computers versus Dell versus Apple. And, you know, and Dell does a great job and they sell millions of computers. But the thing, even at that level of it's all about supply chain, if they can buy it for $5 someplace else, they're gonna. And so that just makes it such a ruthless business to squeeze a nickel out of. If you need to go all the way up to that why of the belief, and that's where you can start to, you know, you, people aren't going to leave you for a dollar. They're willing to chip in a few more bucks because they realize that, you know, now and going forward in the future, you know, you're still going to help them out with the problems they've got and the things that they identify with. So making sure that your brand, you know, really stands for something that people believe in, as opposed to just what your product is, you know, this month, or, you know, it's not focused on you and how we do business. It's about the customer and them. That's the difference between the businesses that survive and the ones that just end up getting ground to death over the long run.
Mm-hmm. Agree. So John, what's exciting you right now?
There's a lot of stuff in that the marketing tools are getting to be better connected and better integrated. And, you know, there's, of course, you know, everybody's talking about artificial intelligence and machine learning and these things. And it does factor into it. But I'm just more interested in the fact that this stuff now all plugs in together better. Like the CRM systems and the email systems are getting to be more interesting now, because it's kind of like as soon as I pull up and get an inbound lead, I can kind of see like, okay, here's their company, here's some things this person's interested in. And you can just become better at what you do because the computer can take so much labor out of it. You know, you don't have to do the manual research to figure out, is this person really a customer? Or are they just a tire kicker? And so that's really kind of the thing that's got me going, is the fact that we can kind of do so much more with less, that, you know, we can behave like a $20 million company, even though we're not to that point yet.
That's true. And I'm not surprised that that's what's exciting you, because for years you guys were hacking all that together with spreadsheets and self-built tools and browser plugins and all kinds of things. So now that the software can do it automatically, I'm very happy for you.
Yeah, it's just like better increased odds of making it home on time at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And then finally, John, who should I interview next on Mate Podcast?
Yeah, well, so one guy that I've been working with, actually, Sean Zinsmeister from Infer. He has a podcast called Stack and Flow that I produce with them. And we're always talking about marketing automation tools and artificial intelligence and just, you know, some of the stuff we had just kicked around. So he's one person who knows the industry, knows a ton of people. Another guy, too, is Thomas Barda. He just came out with a book, The 12 Powers of a Marketing Leader. And his big thing is jumping this gap between the CMO and the boardroom, and the you know, the difference between being a marketer that's just always looking for budget to get things done versus a marketer who's actually growing the business and the rest of the executive suite feel is a valuable addition to the team. And it's all data back too. He's gone through thousands of surveys of marketing employees, performance. Yeah, it's been 360 degrees performance evaluations too. So looking at a CMO and what do his direct reports say about him and what do his bosses say about him. And there's all kinds of interesting things. Like usually the CMO or VP of marketing is usually the lowest ranked employee on the executive team. Mm-hmm. That seat always has a target on its back as the one that, you know, when the budgets get cut, they're the first one that gets fired. And so he kind of delves into that, like, why does that happen? And more importantly, what can you do so that you're not that person? Like, how do you make that jump from just being a marketer to being a successful entrepreneur and business person? And so he's right on the mark with that.
Sounds fascinating.
it's just a great book, and it kind of, again, it can change your whole opinion on how the career ladder is supposed to work.
Yeah, well, that's definitely changing as we know it. So, John, thanks for coming on the show today. Where's the best place people can find you?
Yeah, for this audience here, Marketing Over Coffee is the best place to check it out, over at marketingovercoffee.com.
If you're not listening already, you should be, so definitely go check that out. This was heaps of fun. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to Mate. If you don't already subscribe to John's podcast, Marketing Over Coffee, you need to go and subscribe now. It is an amazing resource of marketing tips and tricks and know-how, and it's jam-packed with practical advice that you can put into action in your business. Thank you, John, for coming on the show today. It was a real privilege. This episode was edited by Josh Armour from ArmourPod Productions. The beautiful, colorful Mate podcast logo is designed by Courtney Carmen. And the music at the top and tail of this episode that gets you in the mood for knowledge is by Nine Inch Nails, used under a Creative Commons license. You can find Mate on all the social media channels at Mate Podcast. Please get in touch. I would love to hear from you. I make this show from my hometown in Melbourne, Australia. I'm your host, Adam Jaffrey, and this was a Jaffrey product. Bye for now.